Thank you.
Sure.
Sorry.
I might not be the person for that, sorry.
Yeah?
But
about time. There's a very fascinating piece in the Shema Shmuel about Parshas Noach, which fits into a general schematic, the Shema Shmuel, which is, I guess, I would call it the most popular theme in the whole Shema Shmuel. It comes back and back again to the theme of the three levels of the human soul, which he took out of the Maral, straight out of the Maral. What he calls the Maral, and he following them call, oh, look at this, it's recovered.
Welcome.
Are you people milchis or fleshies? Because if you're milch, sit over here, we have two chairs here.
We don't want to interrupt because he has to leave early.
Well, early. Okay, that's not a problem.
So there's a getaway over there. Okay,
you can go out this way, there's a door in the
All right, thank you, as long as that's, thank you.
You get a front row seat.
Please,
if you milk it, you can have this. This is
yeah. Thank you, we're Flacia. Thank you.
Okay, as I say, the Maharal explains...
Shame on Flacia.
Maral explains that there are three levels of the human soul. The guf, the nefesh, and the seichel. The physical, the soul as it relates to the physical body, the emotional, the nefesh, and then the seichel, the intellect. So this is the basic theory of man. That man has three levels. Now, the truth of the matter is that according to Kabbalah, man has another two levels above these three. These three are apparent to everybody. Everybody in the world knows that we have a biological side, we have an emotional, we have an intellectual. It's not something which is a new idea. Everybody knows that. There's also two levels which are not so apparent to people. There's a level above which is called different terminology. Sometimes it's called Makabalus Chaya. Chaya means life or life force. And sometimes it's called Tzelem Elokim, the godly image which man has. Now, it means the biological, emotional, intellectual doesn't necessarily show or imply a connection to the godly. And we know that our world is the lowest of all worlds. Our world only exists at the end of a long process which God began. Many worlds between God and this world. So there has to be some kind of a, within man there has to be some kind of conduit, some kind of a pipeline to higher worlds, to spiritual worlds, to God, to angels. So that's called part of the soul, which is called Tzelem Elokim. By the Kabbalists it's called the image. The Tzelem, I guess in this sense, means the connection. Connection to God. In the Shema Shmuel, it's called the connection between Tachtonim and Elyonim, between the lower and the higher parts of reality. And then, beyond that, there's a different thing called Yechida. Yechida is where it's a level of existence where a person loses his individuality, becomes part of the general soul of Israel. Okay, anyway, the sin of Adam. When Adam sinned, so his sin was on all the levels, because it was the first sin. So So it says that the woman, when she saw that the Eitz Hadas, she saw the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So there's different descriptions in the Torah of what she saw before she went and ate it. So it says that she saw that she saw Tova Eitz Lamacho. It was a good tree to eat from. Tavu Hulei Naim. It was very desirous to the eyes. And Nechma the Eitz Lahaskel. It was very attractive, the tree, to for the intellect, for thinking. So it means like this. She saw it was good to eat, so it would taste good. So that's a physical thing. It was a physical attraction. Tavu Hulei Naim. It looked very good. That's more of an emotional attraction. It was aesthetically attractive. And then Nechman, Eitz Lahaskel, she thought about it, that this is something good to eat, because she would now become fully aware of everything in the world, good, evil. She could make a good... Basically, with the Nachash was telling her, according to all the Shem and Shmuel, Nachash, was the snake, was telling her that You'd be a higher level tzaddik, righteous person, if you could make the choice between good and evil. Because God made you good with very little, if any, tendency to do anything bad. So, okay, it's very nice, but it's not an exciting, it's not... a growth experience to live like that. It doesn't prove that one is special, because that's a God-given thing. If you're created a tzaddik, a righteous person, the highest thing would be that the person would have a choice between good and evil and chooses good, despite the temptations of evil and the attraction of evil, stand up to it. That would be that's the highest level. In fact, in a certain sense, what the Nachash, the snake, was telling her is true. It is true that people who make the right choices, despite the temptations of bad choices, are considered by us greater than people who are not confronted with such a choice. That's why, for example, we always... our sages always refer with glowing terms to Abraham. That Abraham went through 10 tests. What were these tests? That to do something bad, or was a very attractive alternative.
Yeah.
Wasn't she, though, in a sense, already having the higher level of making a choice to make a choice? In other words, she was being tempted, so there was a choice.
Yeah,
there.
Right. And within that narrow choice of to get involved in this situation of making other kinds of choices, good and bad, she had a temptation. She had that choice situation. So in other words, vis-a-vis the tree, God did give her a nachash, a snake, to tempt her. But not vis-a-vis other things. So the kinds of human beings today, temptation, bad choices, is all around us. And every place we turn, there's a bad alternative. This was only after she ate from the tree. But before she ate from the tree, the alternative, the only one where there was a pro-con choice, where the temptation was alluring in that sense to do something wrong, was about the tree. That's correct. Now, the thing is, I think I spoke of this about last week, but it bears repeating. God created man to make these kinds of choices between good and evil. And that's what makes man, because creatures which don't have to make choices and only do good things, He also created. He created angels.
What's that? The last thing?
Huh?
angels only do good things. They don't make bad choices. So, angels also only make good choices. Tell them to go someplace else. Angels are also creatures which God created. They only do good things. So that kind of creature God made to do only good things. So what's the point in creating man? That man should have a choice between good and bad. Man should have a choice. So the thing is like this. And also another point, if God created the tree which would create these kinds of temptations for man to get through, or have to make these kinds of choices, eventually man was going to have to eat from that tree. Eventually. But not at that point. As the Ari HaKadosh says, when Shabbos, this was a Friday, when man was created and they had the temptation of the tree and they ate. If they would have waited till Shabbos, they would have been allowed to eat. In fact, it would have been a mitzvah to eat from the tree, because that tree was grapes, according to most of the opinions. And you have to make kiddush Shabbos on grape juice. Also, another thing says it was wheat, so we've had to bake bread and eat the challah for Shabbos. So, you're supposed to, we as human beings are supposed to be, we're supposed to have, make the right choices. But, as I said, there's a difference between the kinds of choices I have to make on a Shabbos and the kinds of choices I have to make during the week. During the week, the alternatives of good and evil are incredible. I mean, evil is unbounded during the week. It has no limits. A person can... I think the Rambam writes in the Guide for the Perplexed, the Moreh Nevuchim, he says that a human being has the potential to be greater than an angel and worse than an animal. Human beings can do evil worse than animals. It's very true. So, and they can do things greater than angels. So that's because during the week, the Yetzer Hara, the evil side, has no limit. However, on Shabbos, it's very much modified. Hashem, someone's keeping Shabbos, so the Shabbos which he's keeping, Hashem makes it. Hashem Pashit, simply he lassos, ties up the Yetzer Hara, and puts the Yetzer Hara away, the evil inclination, and replaces it with a very low level tendencies of doing not the best things on Shabbos. Like people who keep Shabbos, I don't know, I guess the evil temptation might be to come late to synagogue instead of coming to synagogue at 9 o'clock, so he comes at 10 o'clock. But he's not going to be involved on Shabbos stealing, I don't know, other things people do during the week. I mean, I'm not in the real world, so I can't imagine so much. But, and I also haven't watched television in years, so I don't know what's going on. But the different things that people get into in everyday things, stealing, I don't know, maybe you've seen it. I see headlines, there's murders going on, other kinds of things. So it doesn't apply to a Jew. On Shabbos, it's not possible. The temptation doesn't even exist. They call it, like, you know, minor things, minor temptations coming late to synagogue. I don't know what else. Maybe he overeats too much challah and gets a stomach ache. What can a person do wrong on Shabbos if he's already keeping Shabbos? So what? It's so limited, and it doesn't even enter his head on Shabbos to these other things. It doesn't even cross his brain. It's in a different world. He's in a spiritual world. So had Adam and Chav waited till Shabbos before they ate from the grapes or the wheat and the bread, then it would have been a completely different, and the whole Yetzer Hara, the whole evil side, would have been more a question of how much good do you do? How much good can you do? You do good at very efficiently, a very high level, or you're doing it not so well, but it wouldn't have been, it would have been a very, very modified evil side. Because they ate it during the week, it became an unbridled evil, limitless evil, which is very hard to deal with. So that's why God did create the tree of good and bad for people to eat from it and get involved in that thing, but he wanted it to be a pleasant kind of fight. It was like a play fight with the evil side. But because they didn't follow that and they took it right away, so they got an unbridled battle. Now, the thing is, another very important point, and that is that because once this phenomenon happened that man now can choose to be better than angels or worse than animals. It's such a wide range now because of the way it is. So now there's another very interesting corollary which comes out of this. Not every person is born with the same level evil side or good side. They're different kinds of souls. So what happens is like this, God has, because of the concept of a choice, that every person has to have a fair choice, and so if his good side has a greater potential, then his bad side will also have a greater potential for bad. It's not a question, people are given different potentials. Like everybody has different potentials in anything, whether it's mathematics or writing or art. So the same thing applies to good deeds and bad deeds. Some people have potential to do amazingly good deeds, and others don't have that potential. That's not so important. What's important is within the limits of the person's two choices, two sides, he picks the right choice. But there's always this, the concept always is there's a concept of a balanced choice. So if a person has a very strong Yetzer Hara, a very strong evil side, that means he must have a very strong good side. And if you see it has a very good side, he must have potentially a very great bad side. Just a couple of days ago in the Daf Yomim, you learn every day, so the Gemara relates a story that the Gemara says that the bigger the tzaddik is, the more righteous he is, the bigger is his Yetzer Hara, the bigger is his evil side pulling him. Says a story that Abaye, one of the greatest Jewish scholars who ever lived, related a story. He said he was walking on the road, I guess he was making a trip, but he was walking. And he noticed, and as he was walking, he noticed a young fellow, must be a Shiva boy, and there was a girl, and both of them, all three of them were sort of going out of the village to go down to walk to some other village. And No one knew anybody. And he saw that the boy told us not to talk to the girl. And and then it's going on, they take a nice long walk, and then after a few hours, he says, they came to a fork in the road, and the girl said, I have to go to the right, and the boy said, I have to go to the left. So, and then the boy told the girl, it was very nice meeting you, and hope you get to your place very nicely, and I'll go my way. I wish we could continue our trip together, because apparently I hit it off, but we're parting ways, so. Whatever, how you say that in French, and have a good life, and I'll have a good life, and we depart. And Abaye says, and the Gemara Mizrahi says, I was astonished, because if I had met such a girl, I would never let her walk down the other road in the fork. I would go with her. I'd forget about my goal, and I'd go with her, because my Yetzer Hara was so big, I couldn't walk away from a girl I met on the road. The great scholar says, but this boy could do it. Because he wasn't such a big tzaddik, he didn't have such a big yetzer hara. He could meet a girl and go away from her. Didn't have to stick around with her. So you see, the great righteous people are given, they have an internally bigger temptation. And it's also true, by the way, of nations. Certain nations have more spiritual potential than other nations. Like every human being is different than everybody else. So nations are also different. Some nations have a potential to build buildings. The great builders. Other nations have artists. Some nations have more spirituality, closer to God, like the Jewish ones, Jewish people. Therefore, the nation which has more of an affinity for godliness will have a greater affinity to do things which are anti-godliness. That's why you find that the Jewish people have tremendous swings from one way to the other. You say if a Jew is committed to the Torah, of course, he can be very, very righteous. But if not, he could go the other way, God forbid. Yeah.
And there's a tendency sometimes to take on extra gedarim or chumros for certain things. Do you feel that it would be appropriate to take these on, even if you don't necessarily feel the
Yetzer
Hara for it?
I want to say like that. I believe like this. The saying is that temptation and choice is fundamental to the human condition. And what we're also saying is that because A can go into a situation and make the right choice doesn't necessarily mean that B can do it. Because, as we said, people have different potentials for good and evil. So what might be a reasonable challenge for A, and he can make the right choice there, might be that B can't. And it might be that B is a greater spiritual person than A. And because of his greater spirituality, the evil side is stronger in him. So now the things about him, I want to say like this. My theory of choice is that there's two ways of making a choice between good and evil. One way is I'm in a situation, there's good and evil, and I have to choose, and I choose good over the evil. But there's another choice possible. I could choose not to be in that situation where I have a choice of good and evil. I could choose to avoid the situation. So my theory of life, personally, is I'd rather make the choice not to be in the situation where I have to make a choice. I'd rather avoid the confrontation than be there. And that's also a choice to avoid the choice.
Do you feel that that would be some way to like retroactively become make yourself a better tzaddik?
Well, you know, I would say like this: if the price for avoiding the choice is not so great, let's say it's a question of convenience, I'll give you an example. I, for example, on Shabbos, I don't like to walk down the street. The stores are open. Like, I live down there by the St. Nicholas Avenue at the end. Like, the shortest way for me to come to YU, just walk down St. Nicholas Avenue to 187th Street and make a left. That means I walk through 7 blocks of stores open on Shabbos. Which means I have to make them, every time I'm walking by these stores, I have to make a choice, because to look into the stores, as you walk down the block, it's very natural to look into the stores. You see people buying, selling, start thinking yourself, oh, maybe I can buy this. I walk by the drugstore. Maybe I should go buy some tissues. Well, it's Shabbos, I can't. Let's go tomorrow. All these things, I'm making choices. But I don't like to be in a situation I have to think all the way down. I'm going to synagogue on Shabbos. I have to be thinking, oh, I can't go into the drugstore. I can't go buy myself some soda. I can't do this. So what I do, I walk from my house. I walk straight up the hill. It's more convenient because it's a very high hill. To walk up the hill to Audubon Avenue. I walk down Audubon Avenue. I don't see any stores at all. So it doesn't even enter my mind I should go shopping on Shabbos. I don't even see the stores. So I'm avoiding the...
In the case of this Gemara, what the boy should have done is he should have been like Abaye and
Abaye obviously never took a walk with a girl in the road.
Right.
If he would see the girl, he would never say, oh, let's walk together and then we'll part company. No, he would let her go ahead by herself and he would walk on himself.
This boy should have done
this. This boy joined her.
Right. So
he made the point about it. He says, I was surprised I saw a Jewish boy decide to walk down the road with a Jewish girl. And he was a yeshiva boy. So I said he was surprised. But then when he saw that the boy conducted himself so nicely, he said, wow, look at that. I could never do that. My Yetzer is much bigger.
But the boy shouldn't have done, but the boy shouldn't have been doing that in the first place.
It would seem, well, I would say so. Since that's my general attitude towards life, when I read the Gemara, I thought that the boy shouldn't travel with the girl on the train or wherever he's going. The Gemara doesn't say, it seems that I think that the Gemara Dabai does seem to say he wouldn't have, he didn't even think it was the right thing to do. But at the end, because that was because he didn't think, it seems from the Gemara that when Abaye saw that, he thought that the boy would fail in that situation. And when he saw that the boy was able to do it, he said, wow, it means that not everybody has the same evil side. My evil side is bigger than his.
But in today's world, I mean, if you look, I mean, a tzaddik may decide, I don't want to walk by a certain area to avoid even thinking inappropriately for Shabbos. But if you take somebody who has a major yetzer hara, he will do things, obviously, in the world that a tzaddik wouldn't even think of. So therefore, you know, if he's walking in Midtown, he's not even thinking about Shabbos because he doesn't even know Shabbos exists. So therefore, does that mean in the end that he has a great good inclination even though he's not even aware of Shabbos, etc.? In other words, because he's thinking at such a low immoral level, that would suggest that he has a great yetzer.
A great yetzer tov, right. Right, as you said, if a person is in you see a person is actually at a low spiritual level, that means he has a great yetzer tov level, potentially. Exactly.
But because he's at such a low level, in other words, the tzaddik seemingly would be struggling with a terrible yetzer hara, but clearly he's living a life of Yiddishkeit, as opposed to the person who has the yetzer hatov, but has no seeming...
Right. The Gemara makes this point as follows. It says, in the future, after the Messiah will come, so God is going to kill the yetzer hara. Because the Yetzer Hara is only for this world, for us to become tzaddikim. But once the future world comes, so it changes. And we have to think a little bit about that, because why does a human being, if he doesn't have choices? But it means I mean, it'll be like a Shabbos Yetzirah in the future. But the Yetzirah which we have now, this unbridled, limitless thing, which is so dangerous, that's going to be slaughtered. So it says like this, God is going to make a show. He's going to show the dead Yetzirah to the tzaddikim and to the rishayim, to the good people and the bad people. The tzaddikim are going to say, wow, this thing, I was fighting this thing, it's a giant. It's like a giant mountain. How was I able to be a righteous Jew to fight such a tremendous opponent? That's what the tzaddik will say. And the wicked person is going to say, this midget was defeating me. This midget, this nothing, how could I have been defeated by such a nothing? So it means like this, that it turns out that in the large scale of things, the wicked or the immoral wind up doing things which are, they don't even come across the radar screen of the tzaddik. It's something which he would never even, it doesn't mean anything to him. Things which people are into, other people. So it's like Ibn Ezra writes that he says like this. He says the Torah says you shouldn't covet, you shouldn't have chemda, you shouldn't want to be jealous of other people. He says, I cannot be jealous of other people. So he said like this. He says if a person is a poor person, would he ever dream? We ever think realistically that he could marry the king's daughter, a princess? He's a plain person. He's a poor person. How would he ever, like the prince, what's it called, the prince of the pauper? How could a pauper ever think that he would be a prince and marry a prince? He's not jealous. If he reads in the paper, if I read in the paper that, I don't know who princes are nowadays, but in the old days when I was here, there was a prince called Prince Charles. There was, I don't know, a Princess Diana. So Prince Charles married Princess Diana. Am I jealous? What do I have to do with Prince Charles then? It's a different world. Not relevant to me. It's entertainment, but it's not, I can't be jealous. But if a friend of mine marries this girl that I had my eye on, I'm very jealous because I thought I would marry her. So jealousy is a function of what a person thinks is realistic for him, what a person thinks is possible. If he doesn't think it's possible, there's no jealousy. That Ibn Ezra says that the Torah wants us to be so worked out, so developed spiritually, that even things which are we could get, if God makes it work out, if we don't get it, but our neighbor gets it, we shouldn't be jealous. We should realize if God didn't want him to have it for me, it's not for me. Just like the princess is not for me. This thing is not for me either. Maybe it goes against that of the economics of America. America is based upon, oh, if he has it, then I should also have it. So I don't know the exact term in what it's called for, but it's part of the demand for goods. If he has it, I should have it. But it's against the Ten Commandments. The Tenth Commandment is do not covet. Do not be jealous. You get what God has for you. It's not me. It's not God's plan for you. So it's for the guy next door. So, but this is also true about all sins. A sin only tempts if I think I can do it. If I think it could, something I could do, I would do. So then there's a temptation. If it's something which is completely beyond my imagination for me to do, then I have no temptation. So a person who's keeping Shabbos, let's say, he doesn't really have a temptation to drive a car. It's just not something which he even thinks about. Sometimes I heard in my little lifetime, and people told me that people who don't keep Shabbos sometimes will talk to a person keeping Shabbos, boy, that's very hard. How do you do that? It's only hard if a person is thinking, could do this, and I would want to do this, but I have to control myself not to do it, so then it's a temptation. But if it doesn't even cross a person's mind that I could do it, so then there's nothing to tempt me. If I don't have a temptation to drive a car on Shabbos. It doesn't even enter my mind that I could drive a car on Shabbos. A car doesn't exist for me on Shabbos. Someone asks me on Shabbos, do I own a car? I'd say, no, I don't really own any cars on Shabbos. I just don't have it. So forth. I have any temptations on Shabbos. There's certain things which maybe on Shabbos people are tempted to do. Usually it's the kind of things, at least for me, who's keeping us, people keep Shabbos, it's like borderline things which are not so black and white when it's permitted, when it's not permitted. There's certain things on Shabbos which are on the borderline. If you do it a certain way, you can do it. If you do it the other way, you can't do it. So on that border, it's hard. And sometimes it's very tricky to do it the right way. So then there's a temptation. Maybe I'll do it a little bit the wrong way. But basic things like driving a car, riding, going to the store shopping, doesn't even cross people's minds. There's no temptation, because it's beyond that can. So the idea, that's what I was saying is, so it turns out like this, when it says in the Gemara that the tzaddik has a bigger yetzer hara, that doesn't mean that he's actually thinking to do all these terrible things, which other people do, but it doesn't cross his mind, these terrible things. It doesn't cross his mind. It means that at his level, for the things that he has to worry about, there's a very strong temptation, very strong urge to go against.
At his level.
At his level. That's right.
But if there's just as much good, and it's always going to be a fair balance, then why does it matter? Like, what's the difference of it if it's stronger? There's still going to be the same amount of good to cancel it out.
Yeah, it just means it's a strong fight, because you need more power on the good side to fight stronger power on the bad side.
But it's always going
to
be equal.
Potentially. You can always find an equal power of good to counteract the power of evil, but it's not always so apparent that where that power is. You need sometimes to unlock it with a near special effort to discover it. One of the big problems, I think, with the struggle with Yetzer Hara is the lack of people don't realize the potential for good that they have. Which is also, by the way, a Yetzer Hara strategy. Yetzer Hara likes to tell, when we think that we don't have the potential to do it, it's often a lack of confidence, but it's not true. It could come out.
So for the tzaddik, he is struggling with something at a much holier level, but it's a struggle as opposed to the person at the lower level who is fighting a much more basic thing.
Right. And tzaddik, apparently, it's a more difficult fight at his level. Because the opponent would like to get the tzaddik to fail. Because if you get it, it's a bigger prize to get the tzaddik to fail than it is to get the regular guy to fail.
Even if it's a more... Even if it's a struggle at a higher level.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Shouldn't it be easier for the tzaddik? Because in order to get to this level where your yetzer hara is so strong, you have to be able to control it in order to reach the level of the tzaddik.
No, what happens is that the tests become the way it works out. See, every person has a... I have this theory. It's my own personal theory. Every person has a weakness. It's a weakness in his soul. I think that it's one of the people, and I read someplace, describes how does God create a soul. How does God create a soul? So what there is like this, think of an assembly line. A soul is goes through an assembly line process where every step along the way something is put into it. So first stop, soul gets an intelligence. Another stop, it gets it gets certain likes, certain dislikes, etc. So every step, but this assembly line is very interesting. Every single soul, as it goes from stop to stop, and gets anger, love, hate, intelligence, this, that, all the different things, it's never the same as the previous soul. In other words, every single soul gets a unique production. Unique. And so this soul gets a little more intelligence, but a little less patience. That soul gets a little bit more love, a little less anger, and all these different things. Every soul is a unique product. So they, at the end of the process, every soul comes out with a weakness. There's a certain thing, the tendency is a weakness. It's not as strong as other souls. That's where the tzaddik gets tested. He gets tested at his weakness.
Is that where the regular person also gets tested?
Maybe not. A regular person may not be tested always at his weakness, because since he's a regular guy, even his good things he's not so strong. The tzaddik has certain things where he's very strong. But here and there's a weakness. That's where the test is going to come.
And then, does it ever reach an end? Or?
Never really ends. The weakness could be a weak. Let's say in Abraham's case, Abraham was a tremendous. His strength was that he was a tremendously giving person. He gave everything away, Abraham, to other people. There was nothing for him. He was totally dedicated to everybody. That's a very strong point. But on the other side, it was a weakness, because the problem was, could he ever do anything to hurt somebody? So when God tells him, take his son, kill his own son, so his strength turns out then to be an incredible weakness. Because for him, this is very difficult. It's almost like it's impossible to do such a thing. So that's where he was tested.
But didn't he reach his potential
after that? Yeah, the potential was that he was able to overcome that weakness. He was able to do it. Let's say Yitzchak, what was his weakness? That he was a very extraordinary loving father. So he loved Esav as much as Yaakov. So how was he tested? That he has to go against this. He has to reject Esav and take Yaakov and reject Esav. It was his weakness. His weak point, that's what God tested him. What was Yaakov's weak point? His weak point was that he preferred Yosef over the other brothers. So he was tested that Yosef disappeared, and now he has to deal with the other brothers. Always like that. What was Moshe Rabbeinu's weak point? He wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. He wanted to live in Israel. That was his lifetime project, to get the Jews out of Egypt and bring them to Israel. But because he wanted that so much, which was on the one hand a tremendously good thing, but that's not our weakness, because he's so focused on that, what will be if God takes that away from him? He says, you cannot go to Israel. Is he going to get angry at God? Is he going to start complaining to God? Did he lose a little bit of his absolute faith in God? Maybe think a little bit that God's not being fair. That was his test. So in great tzaddik, the strength could be a weakness. So strong in a certain area, what happens if you take that away from him? It's very hard. The tests are very hard because for the tzaddikim, it's at that raw nerve, which is that very weak spot which is left, and that could even be the underside of his strength. His strength produces an underside which is weakness. Because he's so strong in this, what happens if you take that as amazing. The tests are amazing. And you never can avoid them. They're every day. And they always come in the most unexpected moment. Let's say a person is working to control his temper. So he talks and talks and he reads books and this. So he has his temper under control. But what happened was that today in work, his boss insulted him. He couldn't say anything back. And then the guy next door, cubicle next door, got credit for a sale which he really developed. And meanwhile, he was under pressure, so he had to skip lunch. He didn't eat supper. And meanwhile, the train going to work broke down, and he's going home, and he's in a rush hour, and it's hot, and air conditioning failed. And he comes home, and he's, and all of a sudden, his wife says to him, "How come we didn't pay the rent last month?" So he blows his stack. "What do you want from me? You know we didn't have any money." But meanwhile, he's working ready for 2 months, 3 months, reading books day and night, how to control his temper. But what can he do? God put him in a situation which tests him in the worst, unexpected way. He didn't expect his wife when he walks to the house to show him up this rent bill that he owes 2 months' rent. If she would have given him a supper, he'd take a shower, show him the bill, he'd be okay, because then he'd have the control. But not coming in after such a subway ride. But the tests come the most unexpected times, in the most weakest points, the weak spots. Because if a person can overcome them when he's weak, that means he's really very strong. So, Noach, let's get to this week's parasha a little bit. Noach, he lived in this very different, yes.
Says that about Yaakov's tests. He says,
Bikesh Yaakov,
he thought that he was done with his tests. Now he just wants to have a little bit of respite, a little bit of peace and quiet. And so, Miyad Kafat Alav Rosh.
When he was most weak, he got his biggest test. In other words, the test of Yaakov in Lavan's house was a very hard test. 22 years in exile. 22 years away from his parents and his environment, it's very hard. And being with a scoundrel and being tricked, etc. When he comes back to the land of Israel, he figures, I went through the test, I have a nice family, now I can settle down and we'll build a Jewish people. And boom, he gets hit with Yosef disappears, a mysterious thing. The way he was sitting when he was very weak. Completely unexpected, completely different. So this is, yeah, that's right. That's very good. That's a very good example of how the tests come when you least expect them. And the most unexpected ways. Like Yosef himself, he was the prized child of Yaakov. All of a sudden, he winds up, his brothers kidnap and sell him. It was an amazing event. Wind up in Egypt, most unexpected, terrible thing could happen, betrayal of my brothers. So it was unexpected, it was very, that was his weak side, he was hit on the weak side. Right. So Noach, he had to go through it because he lived, it says, in three generations, he saw the generation of Enosh, the generation of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry. And he saw the generation of the Mabul of the flood, it's a generation of incest, of Hashchasa. And he saw the generation of the Tower of Babel, which was a generation of pride, of Gaiva. So, Kinna covered Gaiva, Taiva, all the three vices he had to live through, and he had to be a tzaddik and be able to go through it. Now it seems that Noah's strategy was avoidance, what I said before, because there's no trace in the Torah of Noah getting involved with the other people trying to save them. You get the impression when you read the Torah that Noah was a loner. He stayed away from everybody. And maybe yes or no. See, Rashi brings down at the beginning of the Sedra two opinions, trying to compare Noah to Abraham. Now, Abraham was a great tzaddik who was involved always with people. He took him idolaters into his house and all kinds of people he was involved with. He went from place to place to talk and preach. It's nothing like that for Noah. Yes?
It would have been better for Noah, for Abraham to avoid the temptation.
So that's the thing. So Rashi has two pshatim. Rashi says Noah was a tzaddik in his generation. That's what the Torah says. So Rashi has, why is the Torah saying in his generation? So there are two opinions in Rashi. One opinion is, even though his generation was so bad, he was still a tzaddik. If he would have been by an Avram's generation, was not as bad as the flood. It was bad, but not as bad as the generation of the flood. If he'd been in Avram's time, it would have been much better. That's one pshat. The other pshat, another interpretation is, Noach was great in this generation, but compared to Avraham, he would be nothing. He was nothing in Avraham's generation, because Avraham outshined him like the sun which outshines the moon. That's the second interpretation. It's like this. I would say that maybe this is the argument, because of his strategy of avoidance. Avraham's strategy was to get involved. Listen. Avram was, well, they almost killed him. They threw Avram into the fire because he was trying to make a revolution. Noach, no one ever tried to kill Noach. It doesn't say any place that anyone tried to kill Noach. Because he wasn't a revolutionary. He was he saw it was a very, very bad, so he stayed away. He avoided the palace. His choice was to avoid the temptations. You see one thing. With Noach also, as almost like a proof of this, is that when he leaves the ark, and it says that he makes wine and becomes drunk. And it's written up in the Torah in a very, very derogatory, very negative way. He's dressed, and it's a very negative description, because he was not able to withstand the temptation of drinking the. What happened was like this: when he was on, I'm following this idea, he was on his own. So based the way he was on his own, okay, so he avoided all the temptations. But then, after the flood, when he came out, he couldn't avoid. Someone had to be a farmer, someone had to build, the world was a mess. So, he got involved in all the real things which he had avoided before. It says he became a farmer. Before then, we don't know what Noach was doing. But afterwards, he became a farmer, and he discovered that grapes make good wine, and he drinks the wine, and he becomes drunk. Because, in other words, he was not used to real temptation. Noach was used to avoiding temptation. Staying in the yeshiva, staying in the monastery, living in Borough Park. But he didn't live in Manhattan. He lived in Lakewood, Muncie. He had his own special protective environment. But that was only possible before the flood. After the flood, there was nobody left but him and his sons. They had to do everything. Once he started to do everything, so before you knew it, Noach is drunk. The great tzaddik is drunk. What happened? What happened over here? Would you imagine that ever Avraham Avinu became drunk? Yitzhak, Yaakov, Moshe, never. The answer is like this. Noach was a great tzaddik because he avoided temptation. But once he had to get into the real world and he was tempted, he couldn't deal with it. Yitzhak fell. Avraham, Yaakov, Moshe, these tzaddikim, they were in the real world. They were fighting temptation every day. Whether it was Avraham and all the different places he went, and Yaakov, and Moshe, these are tzaddikim who are in the real world. So they don't have, they defeat the other side. That's why Rashi says they were greater than Noah. Avraham was greater than Noah. Rashi has a beautiful way of expressing it, because it says Abraham walked before God, and Noah walked with God.
And
the student, right? That's against this concept. I'm saying that's that this Rashi, that the policy of avoidance. Listen, the thing is like this. You can. I would say two things. So you're asking a question on my theory, which I mentioned before, that avoidance is the best policy. It's better to be in the yeshiva and avoid things than to be on 42nd Street and have to withstand things. But if a person is on 42nd Street, all he does is collect charity the whole day and give it to the poor, and he doesn't give in to any temptation, is greater than someone who sits, in Muncie. But who's going to tell you to go sit in 42nd Street? It's ridiculous. You put yourself in such a place. So what's the idea? So first of all, could be that God forces people to go into the areas of temptation. Like Abraham. He had no choice. Hashem said, Lefecha, you have to go wander around the world. You can't sit in your house. Or Moshe. Moshe wasn't looking to go to Egypt and be a hero. Moshe wanted to be alone with the sheep in the desert. He says, what do you want from me? I'm happy meditating and praying and doing my things by myself in the desert with the sheep. I don't need to go get involved with Paro and kings and the palace in Egypt. And don't forget, they remembered Moshe. They knew Moshe as a young fellow. Who knows what they could try to tempt him with, based on his old background. You ever saw the movie The Ten Commandments? It's not a true movie. It's full of falsehoods. But in the imagination of whoever wrote that movie, the director, Moshe, when he's a young fellow, has an Egyptian girlfriend. So when he comes back and gets the Jews out of Egypt, this woman, my old boyfriend is here. So she's trying to get Moshe. You know, it's Hollywood. So they put Hollywood into the Ten Commandments. But my point is, a little bit there's truth in this figment of the director's imagination. And when Moshe Rabbeinu comes back to Paro, everybody knows who he is. He was living in Paro's palace. He was a prince of Egypt. In fact, he even made a movie called Prince of Egypt after the Ten Commandments that was full of many more falsehoods. But I'm sure that when he comes back to the palace there, people saying, Moshe, we know you. What are you going crazy with this God, the kick? Come back. Be another prince of Egypt. Power himself tells Moshe, you're my stepson. What are you doing? Why are you making a revolution? I'll make you commander-in-chief of the armed forces. So there was a lot of temptation. Moshe was in the real world. There was a lot of temptation. That's why it's greater than Noach. Moshe doesn't have a downfall. That's because I tell you the difference between why Noach did and Moshe didn't. Because Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, the Jewish tzaddikim, they have a secret weapon, which is called the Torah. God speaks to them and gives them Torah ideas. And Torah is a very Torah is the only weapon the Gemara says that a person can use in the real world against the Yetzer Hara. You can go to a monastery and avoid the Yetzer Hara, but if you're going to be in the real world, he's right there. He's your partner. When you walk down the street, he's there hand in hand. You bump into him all the time. So the only way you can deal with him is if you have the Torah. You have the Torah, you chase him. Yes?
Doesn't Rashi mention that Noah had the Torah, otherwise he would have known which animals were the kosher animals?
Oh, that's true. Noah did learn some Torah. That's true. That's very true. That was probably because it could be that was only the thing about the animals, but not other things. Or because he was going to go into the ark, and he was then going to come out and be the one who runs the whole world, he was given the Torah, parts of the Torah. However, apparently it didn't work for Noah. He had a downfall. He had a downfall. The Torah is not a panacea. There are plenty of people who learn Torah and do sins. It's just Torah is a weapon. It's a strong weapon, but it's not the panacea. It doesn't necessarily mean a person's going to use it and be successful. And I want to say another thing with Noah, because it says he's a tzaddik. I want to the test that Noah had when he left the teva, when he left the ark, was a much greater test than going into the ark. Going into the ark was a very difficult test. First of all, it says that it took him 120 years to build it. And during all this time, everyone's asking, why are you building this giant ship? No one ever saw such a ship. This is the biggest ship in the history of the world. No one had ever seen such a ship. And he was building it for decades. And everyone says to him, why are you building such a huge ship? He says, the world's going to be destroyed. Why is the world going to be destroyed? Because everybody here is evil. And God told me he's going to destroy the world. I have to build the ship. So they would have killed him on the spot for saying such a thing. So building the ship was very dangerous and took a lot of courage. Then going into the ship and locking yourself up in a ship with a bunch of wild animals. And it says in Rashi that the lion actually gave a swipe to Noah and he lost one leg. He limped the rest of his life because the lion gave him a swipe because he was late feeding the lion. The lion got angry at him. So it's a very dangerous job. Anyway, who wants to be in a ship locked up? The whole world is drowning in a flood. So it was very, very, very difficult to be in the ship and to go in the ship. But that test was not as great as the test when you come out of the ship. Because when he came out of the ship, the world was a holocaust. There was an atomic explosion. There was nothing left. Imagine you're the only survivor of an atomic explosion. Go completely crazy. You lose your mind. Where are all your friends? Where are your brothers and your sisters? Noah had brothers and sisters. Where are your cousins? Where are your parents? All of these people died in the flood. His whole family died in the flood, except for his wife and three children. Otherwise, all his brothers, his sisters, his parents, his uncles, his aunts, everybody died in the flood.
Wouldn't you get drunk?
Right, so it's only normal for him to get drunk. So that is saying there was a test. The test was an incredible test. The only survivor of a thermonuclear, 1,000 nuclear bombs explode. The whole world is destroyed. He's the only survivor with his wife. Go berserk. So he drank. This was the only way of solving it. So it wasn't, you can't blame Noah. He was still a tzaddik. But the other tzaddikim would not do that. Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron. They had more power. That's what Rashi says. Compared to them, he was nothing. Anyway, these are role models for all of us, you know. So we hope that as we learn the Sedra and we read about these great people, Noach and Avram, etc., that we get the message in our own lives, as we go through our own tests, and since we're not nearly that level, we hope that we'll never be tested to that extent. But whatever tests we do have, we should be able to be able to do the right decision, do the right thing. And with God's help, since we do have the power of the Torah, which is a very powerful organ against the evil side, no matter what happens, the Torah gives us the light and the path how to stay on the course. So with God's help, we'll be able to do it. Shabbos.
Shabbos.